Good morning. How are you, counsel?
Wonderful. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, it's good to see you. We've got Justice Silver in Las Vegas in the courtroom, and I've got Justice Stiglitz here in Carson City with me. And so I'll call up docket number 79861, Guanera Pastrana versus State. Are you ready to proceed, counsel?
I am, Your Honor. May it please the court, justices, I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant Gustavo Guanera Pastrana, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
I raised 6 issues on appeal, but I'm going to use common sense and start with the jury misconduct issue because I think that's probably what the court is most interested in. And it's Gustavo's contention that when jurors in this case Googled definitions of common sense near the end of deliberations, it was prejudicial juror misconduct. Now, the court's probably wondering how researching an obvious term like common sense could have affected the jury's verdict in this case. Because the district court certainly didn't think it was a big deal. The court said the term was inconsequential, it wasn't contained in the charges against the defendant or in the definitions, and that courts have affirmed convictions on more serious misconduct. But in truth, it's the very ordinariness of that term that made the misconduct so prejudicial. And the crux of our argument is this, that the jurors Googled definitions of common sense during deliberations to pressure one or more holdout jurors to break a deadlock and convict Gustavo of the 2 sexual assault counts. To prevail on a juror misconduct claim, Gustavo had to prove 2 things, 1, misconduct, and 2, prejudice. And there's no dispute that the Google search was misconduct that violated Gustavo's constitutional rights by exposing jurors to extrinsic information. The district court found misconduct and the state concedes misconduct. So the only issue that this court has to decide is whether that exposure to the extrinsic information was prejudicial. And under Chapman, the court has to grant a new trial unless it appears beyond a reasonable doubt that no prejudice resulted. So how do we establish prejudice from extrinsic information? Well, Meyer versus State tells us that extrinsic information must be analyzed in the context of the trial as a whole to determine if there's a reasonable probability that the information affected the verdict. And the court looks at objective factors, such as how the material was introduced, the length of time it was discussed, the timing of the introduction, the nature of the content, and whether it involved a material or collateral issue. And what's important is that not every factor is going to be relevant in a given case. Every jury misconduct case is different and has to be analyzed on its own individual facts. In this case, the objective evidence clearly indicates that the Google searches were very likely used to pressure one or more holdout jurors to convict Gustavo of the sexual assaults. And first, we look at the timing of the searches relative to the verdict. We know that before lunch on the second day of deliberations, the jury had already reached a decision on the lewdness counts. But at 1:20 p.m., the jury foreman wrote a note to the court telling the court that they'd reached an impasse on the 2 sexual assault counts. That's counts 2 and 3. And at 1:55, the court returned a note to the jury with a message, please continue to deliberate. So the jury deliberated for 3 more hours. At around 5 p.m., the jury found Gustavo guilty of all 4 counts. And we found out from the evidentiary hearing that towards the end of deliberations, a few jurors performed Google searches to define common sense and shared the definitions with the group. That evidence tells us a couple of things. First, we know that the searches had no impact on the lewdness verdicts, and that's why I haven't challenged those in this appeal. But second, there's a temporal link between the searches and the verdict on the sexual assault counts. We know the jury broke its deadlock shortly after performing those improper searches, and that's inferential evidence that the searches impacted the verdict. But that's not the only thing we have. We know that the state and the defense both heavily emphasized common sense in their closing arguments. And if you look at my opening brief at page 21 to 22, I identified where the state used that term at least 10 times in closing arguments. The defense also used that term 4 times, and that's the citations are in my reply brief at page 3. And the district court even agreed when it decided to hold an oral or to hold an evidentiary hearing. The court agreed that common sense was central to both parties' closing arguments. And the court seems to have forgotten about that when it issued its decision in the case. Now, even though common sense is an issue in every single case, in this case, it was particularly important. Gustavo himself did not testify, and so the entire defense was relying on discrepancies in MM's testimony, and we were asking the jury to make inferences from the evidence that her accusations were not credible. And the biggest thing was that Gustavo's accuser, MM, had changed her story in a very significant way. When she first reported Gustavo to her mom in July of 2016, she said that he had forcibly kissed her that day and said that she was going to be with him the next day. And she made that same statement to Officer Kravitz and to Elizabeth Espinoza. And she said the same thing at a prelim. But by the time she got to trial, she claimed that the day she reported Gustavo to her mom, the incident that triggered her to come forward, he hadn't kissed her. Instead, he digitally penetrated her and engaged in oral sex, and then told her he was going to force her to have sex with him the next day. And she claimed that the kiss occurred on a different occasion, and she was very adamant about that fact. So what ended up happening was the state had to amend the information in the middle of trial to conform with her team's testimony. And the defense position was that this was a huge red flag for MM's credibility. The state, in return or in response, was arguing that the changes were trivial and that they were asking the jury to use its common sense to discount the defense argument. And, you know, there's a portion of the testimony, or I'm sorry, of the argument in volume 9 at page 2175, where the state actually ties common sense to this very specific defense argument that we were making. And the state says, you know, there was some confusion from MM about the order of events. And then they go on to say, you know, this goes to your common sense, ladies and gentlemen. Common sense is absolutely important in every single case, but particularly in a case like this. And then they go on. So the information you have in this case, ladies and gentlemen, is that the events and how the events were described is the same. It's just the order.
Hey, Ms. Westbrook, I don't mean to cut you off, but the time is ticking pretty quickly, and I have a couple questions, and I think I understand your position from the briefing on this. Address to me why was it error not to have, per Valentine, an evidentiary hearing, the court's comments, and the state's kind of indirect reference to the lack of testimony from the defendant?
Sure. Okay. So I would like to start with, I'll start with the Valentine issue. And, you know, I know recently this court issued an unpublished decision in Rommel Ortiz that kind of had a similar sort of factual setup where, you know, the jury commissioner in that case was alleged to have violated NRS 6.045 subsection 3 by not including unemployment recipients on her list of qualified electors. And in that case, this court said that there was not a, you know, basically it made two findings. Ortiz couldn't prove systematic exclusion, and he couldn't get an evidentiary hearing because the court said it was unclear if the jury commissioner was still violating the statute. And even if the jury commissioner was violating the statute, Ortiz had not proven that African Americans were more likely to qualify for unemployment benefits. So as to the court's first finding in Ortiz, I believe our case is distinguishable because in this case, the district court expressly found that the jury commissioner was not complying with the statute. And I respectfully disagree with the court's finding, second finding. I think we can establish systematic exclusion without presenting evidence of the number of Hispanic individuals receiving unemployment. We have a statute that specifically required the jury commissioner to draw from that source. And the purpose of that requirement was to ensure a fair cross-section. And in our briefing, at opening brief, page 34 through 36, we indicated that based on the legislative history, the purpose of that amendment was to remedy the underrepresentation of minority groups on veneers and to ensure that the jury pool was fairly representative of the community. So essentially noncompliance, our position is that noncompliance with that requirement is prima facie evidence of systematic exclusion. And the briefing in Ortiz didn't address the legislative history behind the new requirement. And so this court's ruling in Ortiz didn't take that into account. In addition, the briefing in Ortiz didn't address the fact that the failure to substantially comply with jury selection statutes has been deemed a structural error in several states. And I cited to those cases in my reply brief, Bearchild from Montana. You know, if you give a telephone jury summons when the statute requires mail service, that's a substantial failure to comply. Sartizan in Montana, 2005, where a master list was age ranked, that was a substantial failure to comply with a randomness requirement. and in Maples 1970 Alabama case, using a voter list was a substantial failure to comply with a requirement that all qualified persons be on the list. So in this case, the jury commissioner's failure to comply with that fourth source requirement is the exact type of failure that's been deemed structural error because it frustrates the party's ability to get a fair cross-section. So I think, you know, notwithstanding the court's ruling in Ortiz, I think we the court here can find a prima facie violation on the record and reverse for structural error. But in terms of the evidentiary hearing issue in Valentine, even if the court doesn't agree that it necessarily establishes systematic exclusion, under Valentine, Gustavo still should have gotten an evidentiary hearing because his allegations could have established systematic exclusion. And when I was preparing for the oral argument, I noticed something interesting about the court's decision in Valentine. Essentially, the rule in Valentine about when a person gets an evidentiary hearing is actually different from the holding of the case. And you can see that if you go to the very first paragraph at page 463 of Nevada Reports, volume 135. The court initially states the rule and says, you know, we hold that an evidentiary hearing is warranted on a fair cross-section challenge when a defendant makes specific allegations that, if true, would be sufficient to establish a prima facie violation. But the very next sentence, the court applies the rule to the facts and says, because the defendant in this matter made specific allegations, factual allegations that could be sufficient to establish a prima facie violation of the fair cross-section requirement, and those allegations were not disproved, the district court abused its discretion by denying Valentine's request for an evidentiary hearing. And that sort of dichotomy between the rule as stated would be sufficient and then the holding could be sufficient, it repeats itself at subsequent portions of this decision. So if you go to page 466 to 467, there's language, having alleged specific facts that could establish the underrepresentation of Hispanics as inherent in the jury selection process, Valentine was entitled to an evidentiary hearing. So it makes sense that the standard is actually could and not would, because the purpose of an evidentiary hearing is to test the defendant's theory. So under Valentine, it's our position that Gustavo was entitled to an evidentiary hearing as long as his allegations, if true, could be sufficient to state a prima facie violation. And without an evidentiary hearing, this court can't say for sure whether more Hispanic individuals appear in the unemployment records or less. But certainly the jury commissioner's failure to comply with the statute could be sufficient to state a prima facie violation. So we believe that, you know, at a minimum, the case needs to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing on that issue. And I'm out of time, but I believe the court had one other question. I'm eating into my rebuttal time.
That's fine.
I believe the court had one other question or one other issue it was interested in.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm good.
Oh, okay. Right. Thank you.
Okay, then we'll reserve the balance of your time. Okay, Ms. Giacomo, are you ready?
I am ready. Thank you. Justices Perigary, Justice Silver and Justice Stiglitz, my name is Sandra DiGiacomo. I'm with the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and I'm here representing the state. I'm going to start with the Valentine question that Justice Stiglitz had. The case here can be distinguished from Valentine. In Valentine, the evidentiary hearing that they were relying on never addressed that specific issue about whether or not certain zip codes were getting the same amount of summons going out. And in this case, it's different because we had previous testimony from the jury commissioner regarding the specific issue that was raised, regarding the fact that the unemployment records were not being utilized in creating the jury pool. And it wasn't because the jury commissioner was refusing. It wasn't that she decided, I'm not going to do it. It was because she could not comply, and that is in the record. The judge said she couldn't comply because that there was an issue with the confidentiality and giving everyone's issue out, and that they're working on a mechanism, and that it was, you know, to get those records and bring them into creating the jury pool. So this case is distinguishable from Valentine. In Valentine, they raised an issue that had not been addressed by the jury commissioner before. But in this case, just months prior, the jury commissioner had testified that it wasn't complying with the fourth thing in the statute because she couldn't comply, but that they were working on it.
Mr. Giacomo, just to kind of wrap that piece up, is that what the jury commissioner's testimony was or the case, is that in this record anywhere? Because the judge in his statements kind of alluded to, I think I remember a case or she said something sometime. Do we actually have the testimony in the record of the jury commissioner?
No, the testimony was not placed into the record. However, defense counsel on page 718 of the record admitted that the jury commissioner had previously testified that there wasn't a mechanism in place for the Dieter records to be brought in at that time. She admitted that. And the judge says, yes, I've had her testimony. I know that she's not complying, and she can't comply. And when the defense even said she failed to do this, he even corrected, said it's not that she's failed, it's that she can't. So there was enough in the record and enough agreement between the parties that would be the record that she would make if she came in, and that's what she had testified just recently on. But when you look at the failure to comply with that subsection 3 of NRS 6.045, that's a legislative mandate. And failure to comply with the legislative mandate does not equal a constitutional or systematic exclusion, a constitutional violation or systematic exclusion. The records that were included at the time were the DMV records, voter polls, and power. And the purpose of adding in the employment records wasn't to get a new base to include in the jury poll. It was to make sure it was as inclusive as possible and a random selection from the most amount of people. So there's nothing that shows a systematic exclusion because those people should already have a driver's license or power or be on the voting poll. So even though they meet the first two prongs, I don't think they can show a systematic exclusion. And if you look at defense counsel's argument at trial, their remedy was they wanted the judge to bring in a new panel. And when the judge even commented, hey, but it's still this same issue if we bring in another panel, and defense counsel said, we understand it's the same issue, but hopefully that panel has more of a cross-section and isn't below the 50% for the comparative disparity. So even defense counsel was admitting that there really wasn't systematic exclusion. It's just that this panel was under or was over the 50%, so maybe the next one would be. So I think that cuts against the systematic exclusion as well. I know I'm counting down. Was there any other issue before I move on?
No.
Okay. All right. And I know, Justice Stiglitz, you brought up the comments in closing argument, so I'm going to address those next regarding the prosecutorial misconduct or the improper closing argument. And what I would submit to the court is you need to look at the entire rebuttal argument to see whether or not the jury would, basically necessarily take the comment to be about the defendant's failure to testify. But if you go back just a couple of pages in the argument, I said when the defense counsel started off with how you guys are all here because this decision has a profound impact on defendant, I submit to you that's not why you're here. You're here because there's been a profound impact on the victim. She's gone through a traumatic experience, and the reason you're here is to hold the state to its burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that what Miley told you is what happened and that the defendant sexually abused her. That's why we're here. This isn't about the defendant. It's about Miley and that we are proving this case. And then a couple of pages later, right before the comment complained about, I said, when Mr. Speed was talking about, and this is, I'm sorry, that first reference was 2210 of the record, and this is 2216. When Mr. Speed was talking about, in this case, the proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that's correct. If you believe Miley beyond a reasonable doubt, then the state's proven its case. But you do have other things to consider. You have her behavior, how she disclosed, who she disclosed to. You have that you get to look at all of it in its totality. And when you look at all of that, it does show the state's proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. And then at 2218, I was talking again about the corroboration for Miley's testimony. And then when you get to what they've complained about, I start with the truth hasn't changed, which was the defense's theme of his argument. It was the truth hasn't changed. And then he said over 14 times Miley lied and even had just PowerPoint slides with nothing but Miley lied on them multiple times throughout his closing. And then at one point, he even left that slide up for probably 5 to 7 minutes. And so that was their theme. So I said, the truth hasn't changed, ladies and gentlemen. Miley didn't lie. The defense wants you to think she did, because if you find that Miley hasn't lied, that Miley stuck to the truth and told you what happened, then the defendant is guilty. It's as simple as that. And then that's where I went on to say, there really are only two people who know exactly what happened in that living room that can talk about it. And that's Miley. And then they objected. And I said, excuse me, let me rephrase. And then I said, there's two people that know what happened, and Miley told you what happened. She told you what he did to her. And then I asked them to go back and deliberate. Look at all the evidence. Look at all the time she's tested.
Ms. DiGiacomo, doesn't the kind of, there's two people in the room, and basically you're only hearing from one of them, doesn't that invite Griffin error? I mean, isn't that Griffin error? Doesn't it invite the jury to take that as a comment on the defendant's silence or failure to testify?
It could. It could, Your Honor. But what I'm trying to say, though, is if you look at just that one comment, sure, it looks like that. But when you look at the entire argument as a whole, between the opening by the state, the defense closing, and my rebuttal, we made it clear throughout that you, if you believe Miley, then he, beyond a reasonable doubt, then he's guilty. So, yes, it appears, and that wasn't my intent, but yes, it can appear from the record that it could be burden shifting, but I stopped it when objected to, and then I took it back to it's all about Miley. So if you take it out by itself, yes, it has that appearance, but when you look at it in the totality of the hours of arguments that the jury heard, I don't think it meets the standard that that they were going to necessarily take that to be a comment on his failure to testify. And I would submit that that one little comment was harmless error because it didn't infect the trial with unfairness to make the resulting conviction a denial of his due process. I'm down to less than 5 minutes. Does the court have any other areas?
I have two, but I'm sure.
No,
my
you go ahead.
Too,
just, you go ahead.
Obviously, the juror misconduct. Because there is juror misconduct, the question is going to be the prejudice issue. And then,
and then
the judge's comments about
okay.
it.
And with regard to the judge's comments, I would submit that when you look again as the record as a whole, that one comment taken out of context did not show a miscarriage of justice, because if you look, the initial instructions to the panel, he said that, the defendant's presumed innocent, and then nobody raised a hand and had a problem with it. And then a specific juror was asked about it, confirmed he understood. The initial instructions to the jury panel, to the jury selected, he said it correctly, as well as in the jury instructions that they had in their hand and took back with them, it was correct. So I would submit that, again, one comment passing over a 10-day trial didn't infect the jury. With regard to Googling common sense, yes, the state submits it was jury misconduct. And the thing the defense can't do here is show it was prejudicial. When you look at the factors from Myers, you know, how the material was introduced, okay, it was done in the room, and when the poor person testified, he said it, he basically infers how quickly it was done, that one of them was confused about the definition and just people kind of did it, and it just happened were his words, and that there was no other research done. So it was something done quickly over the 2 days they deliberated. And, you know, with regard to the second factor, the length of time, he said that the definition was read out loud, but never indicated there was any discussion about it. With regard to the timing, it was towards the end of the deliberations, but it was also after they had already found a verdict on the counts 1 and 4, which we now know were guilty, but at the time when the jury note came out, we didn't know which way it was. But at that point, they had already believed Miley beyond a reasonable doubt on those two counts. So I think,
Mr. Giacomo, what do you make of your answer? I realize it's not you, it's probably Mr. Chen, but it almost looks like it's a concession as to if this court's going to reverse, just reverse on those counts. What's your argument to that? Is that a concession here?
Well, yes, in the sense of if the court finds that Googling was prejudicial and affected the counts 2 and 3, then I think what we are saying is then just reverse those two counts because the jury misconduct came in after they already had verdicts on 1 and 4. So we're not conceding there was prejudice, but if this court finds it, I would submit that, you know, when the court made its ruling, nothing showed that an average hypothetical juror would have been influenced by that definition of common sense. Going back to Myers, it wasn't a definition that they were substituting in place of one that were provided in the instructions. It had nothing to do with the legal the elements of the charged crimes. It's not a legal word that was already defined in the instructions. It's really just a concept that we use for the jurors to understand when they go into that room how they can deliberate. It's a word that has common meaning. And I would submit, if the jury had done it properly, they should have sent out a note that said, could you please define common sense for us? And then at that point, the court could have Googled it and sent back a definition, which I have had happen in another case. So really the misconduct was them doing it themselves, not what they were searching for. But again, I would show that an average hypothetical juror would not be influenced in their verdict by this definition.
Okay, thank you, Ms. DiGiacomo. Justice Silver, do you have any additional questions? Justice Stiglitz?
No, thank you.
I do, real quick.
Okay.
Sorry, Ms. DiGiacomo, we don't know what definition they ended up coming up with, right? We don't know what they looked up on their phones and told each other. About common sense.
The only thing we know is that the foreperson said something to the effect like it was basically the same as what we thought, or each was the same, just a different word. So we don't.
Okay. Thank you.
And I have one question. We've discussed a number of potential errors here, and you pointed to harmless error in a number of cases. Can you take a look at and kind of walk us through the cumulative error and whether or not if we looked at cumulative error would it warrant reversal, and tell us why not?
Well, one of the first factors to look at with cumulative error is whether or not the issue of guilt is close. And I would submit it's not. I know the defense says it is, but all of the arguments the defense raises in their briefs is that were all things argued to the jury and all things the jury rejected. They found that they believed Miley didn't lie and they believed her beyond a reasonable doubt. So, and also there was corroboration. And something a little different in this case too is you had so many times that she discussed it that the jury got to see. When the officer showed up, there was body cam evidence that was presented. There was the prelim testimony presented, the forensic interview, the testimony at family court. So they had a lot more than just her testimony at trial. So I would submit that the issue isn't close. With regard to the quantity and character of the error, I would submit that there's no errors or combination thereof that are so great to warrant such a reversal. I would submit this is different than the Valdez case. In the Valdez case, you had prosecutorial misconduct, which I think but the court found that they weren't enough to reverse the conviction. But then when you took that with the fact that the jury was not instructed properly and the jury also deliberated guilt and sentence at the same time, I think then you have a more cumulative error. But just the fact of Googling common sense, the issues that they raise of prosecutorial misconduct with the improper closing argument and the panel, the jury instructions, you know, I'd like to point out that with regard to the one jury instruction regarding no contact, as they call it, in the reply brief, Ms. Westbrook or the defense had said, well, if the state wanted a jury instruction about that you don't have to touch the bare skin, they should have asked for it, which is what we did. The state proposed to constitute a lewd or lascivious act, it's not necessary the bare skin be touched. The touching may be through the clothing of the child. The defense objected when we provided the cases. That's when the judge changed it to the language exactly out of the Cantano a case. Okay. So, you know.
I think I got an answer. And the last factor, certainly we can address. So thank you.
Well, and I would submit that the gravity of these charges are, you know, it's right. A sexual assault and a lewdness. So I would submit that that was grave.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Westbrook, I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes. Let's address the cumulative error analysis first, and then whatever you wanted to go back and wrap up.
Of course, Your Honor. So essentially, I mean, the first thing that my opposing counsel has mentioned is that the evidence, she believes the evidence is overwhelming. Well, this is essentially a type of he said, she said type case, you know, where you have no witnesses to the incident other than the people who were present. There wasn't video evidence. There wasn't semen found. Those are the types of cases or the type of evidence that you would have in a sexual assault case that would be deemed an overwhelming evidence type case. I would submit that certainly there was sufficient evidence for a conviction. I haven't raised an insufficiency of the evidence argument here, but when you're looking at cumulative error, the question is really, was it overwhelming or not? And in this case, the evidence wasn't overwhelming. It's particularly when you look at the discrepancies in the victim's testimony on key issues such as when, you know, what prompted her to come forward and what happened the very day that she came forward. We also had presented evidence that she had learned that year a friend of hers had also, you know, gotten rid of her stepfather by making allegations. There was testimony that the victim in this case, you know, didn't like her stepfather. He wanted her to have a job. She didn't have that. You know, she refused to do that. It was conceded that he had said, you know, you get out of the house if you don't work. I mean, that kind of stuff was at issue in this case. So there was also the question, specifically as it relates to the sexual assault counts, that the first time she disclosed either penetration or the oral sex, she was essentially prompted to do so by leading questions by the investigator, by the cop, and by Elizabeth Espinoza. So we had a basis to attack, the facts in this case and her allegations. In terms of the types of errors we have, I mean, we've already pointed to the jury misconduct issue, which seriously undermines the sexual assault allegations. But we also have the issue of the jury instruction on Cadiano. I mean, in Cadiano, that was a case where the defendant was alleged to have encouraged some boys to masturbate, but he never actually touched them. And the Supreme Court said in that case that if you have a situation where the defendant threatened, coerced, or instigated a lewd act, touching isn't, physical contact isn't required. But in this case, the lewdness allegations, count one charged Gustavo with touching her genitals, count four charged Gustavo with kissing her. Both of those, as a matter of law, require physical contact. So essentially, by giving jury instruction number 9, saying a lewd or lascivious act does not require any physical contact between perpetrator and victim, you're essentially undermining the very heart of those two claims. So I think that's a serious error. You don't give, if the state wanted an instruction about the skin-to-skin touching, that's the instruction they should have gotten, not an instruction saying that physical contact itself is unnecessary. We also have the issue with the flight instruction, where, essentially the jurors were told that the essence of flight embodies the idea of deliberately going away with consciousness of guilt and for the purpose of avoiding apprehension or prosecution. But because the defendant in this case was from Honduras, there were issues about whether he might have been, if there was flight, which we did, disputed, if there was flight, it could have been because he did not, he was worried.
I'm sorry, on that yes, flight sir. Instruction issue, was that litigated? I mean, before
it
went
was.
To the jury?
And so the defense proposed an alternate instruction that was essentially an inverse flight instruction, where we wanted the court to instruct the jury that if the state fails to prove that the alleged flight was done with the consciousness of guilt and for the purpose of avoiding apprehension or prosecution in this matter, it should not be considered circumstantial evidence. We really wanted to focus the jury on the fact that flight has to relate to the crimes that are being charged and not to possible reason.
But at trial, was there any evidence that it was for any other purpose? Or was this all litigated pretrial? That's the question.
Some of it was litigated pretrial, but there was a jury question. The jurors, during the testimony of the stepson, JJM, one of the jurors submitted questions like, was he, would he potentially have been concerned about, immigration consequences? And so that was raised. It was clearly in the jurors' minds. So that's the second issue. And if I can have just another moment.
I'll give you one more minute to wrap up.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. So we have the two, those two big jury instruction errors. Then we have the issue with the comments in closing, and the state has conceded that the comment that was made, there are two people who know exactly what happened in that living room, and that bedroom, that can talk about it, and that's MM, and essentially, the state has conceded that could be taken as a comment on the defendant's failure to testify. And this is an argument that the state makes in a lot of cases. And I think it would be wonderful if the court could issue some guidance on whether that's even an appropriate argument, because I see it happening a lot. And I think under Harkness, I believe it is a statement that could naturally or would naturally and necessarily be a comment on the accused's failure to testify when you're comparing one person who testifies and another person who doesn't. And so when you look at all of those things together in a case that is not an overwhelming evidence case, I think reversal is warranted here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very good. Counsel, thank you for being with us today for arguments. This matter will stand submitted. We'll stand in recess until 1:00.